Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. On this podcast, case files number 3, we're going to talk about some more exercise-related case reports. Now, again, case reports are write-ups of real patients, clinical presentations, and their course of care. And I'm going to present them piece by piece to the second most handsome doctor in North America. It's Dr. Austin Baracchi. It's going to be a sort of mystery case. He loves doing these. He doesn't admit to it. He won't say that he likes these podcasts the best out of all the ones that we do, but he does. If you see his face, you saw him lighting up on the other end of the line right now, you'd be so happy too. It's Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Hey, you surprised me with a different podcast topic today. So I came in prepared to discuss something else that I think we're gonna punt to next week. And so now I'm shifting my state of mind to go back into Dr. Brain mode, I guess.
Well, this is what I had to do to try to trick you. I had to lead you somewhere under, you know, false pretenses and then switch it up last minute and really hope to spin your brain. And hopefully, I'm predicting, last time I had a pretty aggressive prediction. I said you were going to get 1 out of 2, and you know, the listenership said you got 2 out of 3. So that's fine. I predict 1 out of 3. So we'll, you know,
I guess we'll see what happens. You know, it is an interesting exercise. Obviously, I do these kind of things regularly with my learners and in the residency program where I teach. And the more I've done them, it is an interesting exercise because a lot of the time, you know, you're having to sift through literally the entirety of your fund of medical knowledge, like off the dome, on the fly in real time, which is a very different challenge compared with how actual medical practice tends to go. You know, in some situations, like in an outpatient practice, you might have a patient who comes in with something and you're trying to figure it out and you say, all right, we'll do some things and then I'll have you come back in a few weeks or a few months. And you have all that time to, like, you know, stew over it and read and look things up or whatever. Or inpatient in the hospital setting on a regular medical ward, you know, I might have a patient who's admitted, they're there, you know, for days on end potentially, and I can see them and think, and, you know, we can run tests and look up research papers and talk to colleagues and all sorts of stuff. And then the extreme would be like in a critical care setting where somebody's like dying now and you have to figure something out. Although at that stage, there's many fewer possibilities of, you know, the final common pathway to death there's not nearly as many possibilities of what could be going on at that point. And so it is kind of an artificial exercise to do these kind of things where you have to think on the fly and come up with all of this in real time, but it's also a fun challenge too. And so that's, I think, part of the added, enjoyment about it, and something that can be very impressive when you watch or listen to like a real expert clinician, just crush these kind of things on a, for a really complex case.
Yeah, I also think it's useful to kind of go through what's the thought process, because whether you know it to be true or not, you probably do this with most other questions you come across, like just how you assess, okay, what is the real question? What sort of decision do I need to make regarding this question? And like, how does that influence what I do in the future? So I think it's pretty instructive, and also kind of gives us a chance to maybe expand our listenership's fund of knowledge with respect to how they're thinking about relatively benign things, just like joint pain. For example, we're going to have a couple cases of joint pain, or a decrease in performance. And people are like, yeah, well, you know, maybe you're just a little tired, or maybe
just
you're
deload,
just a little,
you know, reset.
Yeah, but you know, more complicated than that in some cases. But before we get into the cases, we'll just do a little plug here. We have new articles on the website. Dr. Austin Baracchi wrote a really great piece on the top three mistakes that people make during rehab. So if you haven't checked that out, it's on the website. I've got my creatine article that's there for a reference. I don't know that anybody really needs to learn anything more about creatine, but if you were ever wondering, like, does creatine do X, Y, or Z? I assure you it's in there. Or if your mom is worried about you taking creatine, maybe send that to her. Could be useful from a safety standpoint. Or
probably
if you're a clinician,
won't change your mind, but
No, but at least you have receipts, right? So those articles and more are up on the website. We're also coming to Europe this summer, Ireland and Switzerland. So I'm pumped. I need to figure out if I'm taking my golf clubs, and if so, like, how long am I going to be over there? Because I think if I'm over there for like a month beforehand, like, you guys have to come find me out on the links. So that'll be interesting. Also released a new template, General Strength Conditioning 2. It's our kind of next step in folks who are looking to get both real, real strong and real, real well conditioned. So marrying those things together, in addition to a pretty long commentary about how I think about conditioning, programming it, measuring it, things of that nature. And last but not least, we restocked pretty much all of our apparel. So if you've been waiting to pick up some Barbell Medicine swag because you got a PR attempt coming up, or you just want to look fashionable in the gym, all that stuff's available on our website. Okay, all that shameless plug out of the way. Austin, you ready for this?
Ready as I'm going to be.
Yeah, and you know, unfortunately, you should know when I can't share with you an outline beforehand.
I know, like, what's coming now, yeah.
You know what's coming, yeah, that's right. Okay, here we go. First case, 14-year-old male presents to an outpatient sports medicine clinic for right shoulder pain after throwing a football at practice the day before. The patient says he plays wide receiver, but he throws often in practice. After a few throws the day before, he had immediate pain in his right shoulder, which he describes as sharp and localized to the front of the shoulder. He denies any numbness, tingling, or loss of strength otherwise, except for the pain. Interestingly, 3 weeks ago, the patient was tackled onto his right shoulder, resulting in 7 out of 10 pain, according to the patient, and a trip to the sports medicine clinic the day after. At this time, active range of motion and strength in the right shoulder were normal and symmetrical to the left side. Of note, the patient did have pain and flexion on the shoulder, but x-rays at the time were normal. The patient was diagnosed with a contusion of the shoulder muscle and prescribed NSAIDs as needed, plus 2 weeks rest from football. Per the patient, the symptoms completely resolved in this time frame and no follow-up was provided. So again, he's presented to the patient, to the clinic, again, after this 3 week history of a right shoulder trauma. And he says, hey man, my shoulder hurts after throwing this football. Any initial thoughts here?
Sure. So the first caveat, of course, is that I've not seen or treated a 14-year-old patient in about a decade at this point. But, you know, they're put together more or less similarly. So
pediatricians in the audience.
We're dealing with acute onset monoarticular joint pain, meaning a single joint that is painful. And there's a whole diagnostic approach to that. But the first branch point, even before I go into nerding out on various causes of monoarticular arthritis, would be, or arthralgia, to think about, obviously, the traumatic history that we have here. There's the trauma a few weeks before that seemingly had a pretty benign evaluation, and then a recurrence of discomfort now after throwing a football. It'd be useful to get a little bit more characterization to see how similar is what he's experiencing now to what he had a couple weeks ago. And then the thought process from there would be actually pretty similar to what I described, I think, in our first case files episode, because I think the first case on that might have been also a patient with shoulder pain, where I talked about all the structures of the shoulder itself, the bony anatomy, the soft tissue anatomy, ligamentous, tendinous, and muscular structures around the shoulder. And then all the structures that can either refer pain to the shoulder or manifest with shoulder pain. That can be things relating to the apex of the lung on that side, for example, heart, things below the diaphragm, like the liver and gallbladder and things like that, that can all refer pain in that direction. And so, you know, I do want to get a sense of how likely is this to be an actual musculoskeletal pathology affecting the shoulder itself? Is it the shoulder joint or the periarticular structures around it? And if that evaluation ends up being completely benign, then we might have to broaden our search, kind of like we did in that last case from the first episode. I won't spoil it if people have not listened to that and are hearing this now. You can go and check that one out. So I guess those are my initial thoughts, with caveats of I may forget things that happen to 14-year-olds uniquely, but I don't think there are all that many.
Yeah, correct. And yes, I picked this case knowing that you would initially complain about the pediatric population here, but can confirm this has nothing to do. There's no pediatric specific knowledge that you would need to solve this case. All right. So let's move on to the exam and get in some imaging that the clinicians obtained. So vital signs, normal, appears to be a well-nourished, well-groomed kid just sitting on the exam table. Patient is, again, well-appearing, adolescent, sitting comfortably, no apparent distress. A focused physical examination on the shoulder was performed. On exam, there were no deformities, no redness, no swelling, no tenderness to palpation. Skin was intact. Over the AC joint, the patient did note some tenderness, particularly at the lateral acromial edge, so that's outside the shoulder. Active range of motion was limited due to pain and strength in two of the rotator cuff muscles, the supraspinatus and the infraspinatus, were decreased slightly, and the resident notes that it's 4+ out of 5. Elbow flexion and extension strength were normal on the right side and symmetrical to the left side. The extrinsic and intrinsic muscles of the hand were also normal for strength and symmetrical to the left side. His neurological exam was unremarkable and his radial pulses were full. All right, so that is his physical exam. I'll give you some imaging because they obtained that as well. Repeat shoulder x-rays were obtained in the office and compared to a previous radiograph. Compared to the previous imaging, the radiology report stated that there was a 1 millimeter widening of the right proximal humeral physis. That's the growth plate of the right humerus. An MRI was ordered to assess rotator cuff injury versus growth plate injury, and the patient was withheld from sports while waiting for the MRI study to be done. So now that we've got some more information here, any changes in the way you're thinking about this?
Yeah, I mean, we found, it sounds like, some musculoskeletal signal here. If there was some reproducible pain or potentially even some pain-related weakness of a few of the cuff muscles, and then some tenderness on the AC joint, you know, AC joint separations and things like that are certainly something that can happen, although, you know, the worse that worse of a degree that that is, the more apparent it would be on the radiograph or on the x-ray. Caveats include that x-rays have limitations, and they are also read by humans, and humans also have limitations, and so you can get differences in the quality of your radiology interpretation depending on the expertise of the person reading it. So I've had, you know, various musculoskeletal MRIs, for example, that don't really give me much useful information, but if I have an actual expert and musculoskeletal radiologist take a look at it, they may be able to provide additional insight. And so I always, in the back of my mind, have the caveat of what's the likelihood that this report that I'm getting is ultra high quality and giving me the information I need, and should I seek additional expert opinion or re-evaluation of this sort of thing. So is it possible that we're dealing with a musculoskeletal, shoulder, or periarticular related issue here? I think that's very reasonable suspicion, given that we found some signal around there. Could that also be incidental? You know, we happen to find a sore shoulder in a kid that's thrown a football, and yet this other shoulder pain he's having is from something else. I have to entertain that possibility in the back of my mind, too. I think that if this is particularly painful or limiting, debilitating, something like that, then the MRI is the next step. Seems like a reasonable strategy here.
Yeah, I just think the overwhelming clinical picture right now is like, okay, you had this trauma, you know, relatively recently, and then, you know, you had additional musculoskeletal pain, and the rest of the exam and presentation is relatively benign. And so, you know, you're thinking, well, most signs point to this being some sort of like trauma related, overuse, maybe injury related thing, but you have to keep or maintain clinical suspicion until that's like definitively shown, either through resolution of the symptoms or through your workup. And I think that's one of the pearls to take away from this. Just like, yeah, all signs point to this relatively benign sort of pathology, but I still have concerns, which is why you want to kind of put a bow on it and not just ignore it.
Yeah, and I've seen enough weird things happen to people over time that, you know, if there's any aspect of the case that doesn't really fit what I would expect, then that's another reason to broaden the search. And that's exactly what happened on multiple previous cases that we've done here, where you presented something, I'm like, well, it sounds like this, but this one feature sticks out as like, that doesn't fit. So that's going to send me in a different direction. I haven't heard anything yet that's, you know, sending me wildly off into a different space at this point, like, oh, this kid has a history of sickle cell disease and has a septic joint or something like that. Like that's a, you know, that would broaden things or send me in a different direction. This so far seems to be, you know, I would keep my attention there until something pulls me in a different direction.
Speaking of weird things happening. So 3 days later, the patient's mother called the office and reported a significant increase in pain requiring the use of acetaminophen, that's Tylenol. And the patient had a fever. She said she measured to 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. And when asked, the patient actually denied any recent illnesses or sick contacts. Mom said she's concerned about her son and is going to take him to the ED. Now, in the emergency department, the patient's vitals are significant for a fever to 100.4, elevated blood pressure, 134 over 75, and he's tachycardic to 104 beats per minute. Labs were obtained in the ED. You're just doing some chart checking before you go in and see the patient. Labs were significant for a white blood cell count of 10.8. ESR, so erythrocyte sedimentation rate of 58, and CRP, that's C-reactive protein, of 191. Blood cultures were obtained. Those are negative. And they had a viral panel for COVID-19, influenza A and B, and RSV. Those were all negative. MRI with contrast was ordered, but the results have not been obtained before you see the patient again. Anything stick out to you at this particular point?
Yeah, a lot. And it's kind of amusing, my last comment right before you presented that information about the septic joint. So now we're more in the realm of an arthritis, and we have a presentation of an acute monoarticular arthritis, a single joint that is inflamed, and the evidence for inflammation includes not the pain is not itself is sufficient to claim that it's inflamed, but if we saw redness and swelling and stuff like that of the joint, that would be one feature. The others are the fever and then the CRP being extremely elevated in this patient. ESR is also a bit elevated, probably for a 14-year-old. That's just one that tends to go up and down a bit more slowly. So a very acute inflammatory process, the CRP will tend to skyrocket. And so the differential diagnosis for an acute monoarticular inflammatory arthritis like this is typically either a septic joint, meaning that there's an infection within the joint space, which can be, you know, the most concerning of which would be bacterial. But you can also get other types of joint space infections or periarticular infections. And the other is some form of a crystalline arthritis. That would be things like gout, which I do not expect to see in a 14-year-old outside of other unusual situations relating to, you know, like leukemias and lymphomas that can lead to uric acid related complications. And then pseudo gout is another, you know, cousin of gout, calcium pyrophosphate deposition that can also cause a ton of inflammation in joints. Also would be very, very unusual to be in a child. And then if there's not a truly a monoarticular arthritis, but basically you have an inflammatory process that can affect multiple joints, but it's just early and it's just manifesting in the first joint, but later on we're going to start seeing it in other joints, then that's another potential issue. And so the first and most urgent, you know, concern would be, is there a joint space infection? Infections that can get into joints can be things like gonorrhea, for example, can infect joints, many other bacteria and organisms that I don't need to get in a long list for. And the way to diagnose that is actually to insert a needle into the joint, drain some fluid, do a Gram stain culture, do some other labs on that fluid. And so typically that would be something that should happen very, very, very quickly because joint space infections can be pretty dangerous. And so that's my initial thought. I have a patient with clear evidence of inflammation in terms of symptoms, vital signs, labs. They have this joint that is very acutely inflamed. And so the top two concerns are usually infectious and crystalline arthritis or arthropathies. And between the two, infections are more dangerous in the short term. And crystalline disease would be less common to present in a child, as far as I know. There's many other causes of inflammatory joint disease, but we're not seeing that in many other joints manifesting quite yet. So other conditions associated with vasculitis and various other sorts of things can, and autoimmune diseases can manifest with joint pain and joint inflammation. But We don't really have a ton of signal for that yet in other joints or in other organ systems. Like, you know, if he gave us a rash or he had eye symptoms, mouth symptoms, kidney problems, urinary issues, things like that, I'd start looking even more broadly for a systemic condition.
Yep. Yeah. So they consulted peds, orthopedic surgery. They came and looked at the MRI along with radiology, basically showed just edema over the right AC joint without any evidence of bony injury. They didn't feel like there was something there that they could tap. So they just started him on intravenous antibiotics for presumable septic joint. So he started on IV vanc and ceftriaxone for 4 days. His fever, pain, and range of motion all improved over the course of treatment. He was discharged after hospital day 4 and sent home with a 6-week course of oral antibiotics, clindamycin 600 milligrams 3 times a day. And the patient returned to lower body exercise 1 week post-discharge and started upper body exercise after his oral antibiotics were completed. So the ultimate diagnosis here was septic acromial clavicular joint arthritis secondary to injury from throwing. And the pearls here that I wanted to talk about were, one, the return to play, and then, two, this sort of differential diagnosis that you're going through with respect to joint pain. So actually, let's start there, just this differential diagnosis. You know, there are some, you know, we talk about red flag signs and symptoms, particularly like low back pain. So that would be somebody with low back pain who's got a history of cancer or with who has weight loss or fever or, you know, something, you know, bowel or bladder dysfunction. Those things get you worried that something else outside of non-specific low back pain, the run-of-the-mill type, is occurring. Well, in musculoskeletal pain, there's a similar sort of idea, like what sort of signs and symptoms would tip you off? So the presence of constitutional signs, so things like weight loss, fever, fatigue, or whatever associated with joint pain, you're like, that's not typical from like a overuse or traumatic kind of thing. And these would be identified either through the sort of patient interview or a review of symptoms. And you're just asking questions like, hey, is your appetite decreased? Have you had fever? Have you had night sweats? Things like that, weight loss, whatever. Also, if a person has a medical history associated with joint pain, like multiple, particularly in multiple locations. So if somebody has like ulcerative colitis or other sort of conditions, you would start to worry like, maybe this isn't just your standard, you know, benign shoulder pain. Maybe it's something else going on. The severity can also be concerning. So whether it's just severity of pain, although that's not, you know, super specific, but if somebody had 10 out of 10 pain compared to 2 out of 10 pain, well, that would be something to be worried about. Same thing with range of motion. So in general, when people have a sort of what you would consider a mild, you know, sort of joint pain, they can still move it through a relatively complete range of motion. Some of it may be limited, you know, due to fear or guarding and such. But if somebody cannot move their limb at all, well, now you start worried about not just fracture, but also like infection or other sort of, you know, accumulative process, like you were mentioning with gout and pseudo gout. And significant strength changes, particularly those that are consistent with like a neurological etiology. So whether it's flaccidness, whether spasms, cogwheeling, rigidity, like all sorts of stuff, there's just a laundry list here. Those things would, the severity thereof would kind of tip your brain to think, maybe this isn't what I'm thinking. Maybe it's not as benign as I was originally considering. As you mentioned, the number of joints, right? So if this patient had like bilateral shoulder pain or shoulder and knee pain, and you're like,
he's probably got gonorrhea in that case, which is why they gave him ceftriaxone.
Yeah, totally. It is possible, of course, that, you know, these things are unrelated, but, you know, there's a bit of Occam's razor kind of going on here. And then I think one thing that is probably most important for folks to take home is a consideration of the antecedent history. So like what happened directly before? Is there a history of trauma? This patient, yes, there was, although kind of a red herring in some ways, because it starts just you down that pathway. But if they have a history of previous infection, a previous history of rapidly increasing activity, you could start thinking about stuff like rhabdomyolysis or compartment syndrome, for example. So taking all of that stuff into consideration is important when you're trying to come up with a diagnosis. And the importance here of coming up with a diagnosis is because it would change what you do with the person, right? And so all of these are, you know, what you would call like biological sort of contributions to the pain experience. And you're considering those to the nth degree, because it would change your management. Now, you're not trying to differentiate between two separate causes that have the same treatment, because ultimately, like, well, why does it matter? But only the coming up with a specific diagnosis is most important for when it changes what you actually do with the person, you know?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, it sounds like they treated this patient, you said, with vancomycin, which would cover a ton of different kinds of bacteria, and then the ceftriaxone, which, as I mentioned, mainly covers, we do that for gonorrhea in this type of situation, but would also cover a ton of gram-negative types of bacteria. And then they gave him a long course afterwards, which is also typical for an infectious arthritis. I feel bad that they gave him 6 weeks of clindamycin. That's a rough antibiotic to have somebody on for that long, especially a kid. But that aside, it sounds like he got better. This is also a super unusual scenario. Basically, typically to get infection in a joint space, it usually gets seated there somehow. So a lot of times patients with bloodstream infections that can lead the bacteria to be able to get into the joint space, or other ways would be if there's direct inoculation of bacteria into the joint space. So if somebody sticks a needle into a joint to give you a steroid injection and they don't use sterile technique, that can get it infected. If you have a prosthetic joint, and that you have a surgical site infection, obviously there was a bunch of instruments and potential contamination that happened in there. For this, it sounds like there was no, inoculation instrumentation, no bloodstream infection. They didn't grow anything on blood cultures, at least for whatever that's worth. So pretty odd to have this. I would be hesitant to call it something like a trauma-induced septic arthritis when there wasn't really anything that got into the joint, as far as we can tell. But anyway, that story all makes sense and as far as what happened. And you're right that all of that diagnostic consideration that I was describing really is to differentiate things that need to be managed differently. So if this patient hadn't gotten antibiotics, for example, and somebody just continued to brush it off as, you got a shoulder sprain or something, then yeah, he probably wasn't going to get better because he was fevering and was, not doing great. As far as general musculoskeletal pain kind of syndromes that we deal with in our rehab practice, for example, outside of these medical scenarios, there's a lot of people out there who love getting down into the weeds and trying to identify a very specific structural quote unquote pain generator or something like that to give people very specific rehab exercises. And, it's pretty debatable, in my opinion, the value of that kind of an approach for many of those conditions compared with evaluating what are the patient's symptoms, what are provocative, issues for them, and then going through kind of an iterative trial and error process of movement and see what's tolerable for them, and then dose it according to their tolerance, and then adjust the dosage of their programming, volume, intensity, frequency, based on their response. So if they're getting better, great, you're on the right track. If they're not getting better, change your exercise selection, change your intensity, change your volume to get below, a threshold of tolerance. Or some patients are so sensitive that I might need to take a break from a certain activity entirely, withdraw, a movement and do something completely different for a bit of time. That's just being a good clinician and responding to the rehab trajectory of the patient that you're dealing with. So that's kind of more in the musculoskeletal rehab realm, but definitely in the medical realm, like this is where the rest of my brain operates, of thinking through all the things that would require unique management. If it was infectious, he needs infectious therapy. If it was a crystalline thing, I would have to treat that directly. If it was an autoimmune condition, that would be treated very differently. If it was, malignant associated, joint, or if this kid ended up having some kind of, humerus osteosarcoma with a pathologic fracture causing pain in that area, that'd be a very different kind of management strategy, because that would be cancer. So that's why I care about diagnostic labels, is it guides the subsequent treatment approach in a way that is more likely to lead to a good outcome compared with just throwing anything at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah, for sure. The last thing I wanted to talk about before we move on to the next case is this like return to play idea. So like on the one hand, I would celebrate that these physicians, said, hey, you can get back to lower body training, right away, pretty much go for it. Because to me, that's a pretty liberal recommendation. Just like, hey, yeah, go for it. But the recommendation to not do any upper body stuff for 6 weeks, I mean, to be clear, this is made up, right? This is just a CYA, a cover you can fill in the rest sort of recommendation. Like, well, look, if we're calling this septic joint secondary to trauma from throwing, well, then you have to at this point limit activity because you thought that's what set it off. But to your point, that would be pretty unusual way to get septic joint. In fact, I'm not sure that the mechanism really makes sense to me, but I suppose anything's possible. I just wonder, when you have a client or a patient who's like, well, doc, when can I get back to the gym? I've had this thing. It is interesting because most of those questions come directly to you when you are not the actual provider in most cases. You know, like you haven't assessed the patient, you don't know all of the other stuff going on, what's their treatment plan, et cetera. You don't have a good sense of who this person is as a patient. And so, and further, you're trying to navigate the situation where another doctor said this other thing. And you're like, well, no, he would just tell you that they were, you know, full of it. Not generally recommended. So I think what we would recommend, and you can weigh in on this, I'd like to get your thoughts on this. When you are asking about return to sport, return to play, I think it needs to be a more expansive conversation than just, hey, doc, when can I go back to the gym? And they say, don't lift 20 pounds, more than 20 pounds for the next 4 weeks. And they're, as they're walking out the door. And, you know, they're not doing it to be dismissive, but, you know, in general, clinical practice is very busy. So, you know, understanding of their time considerations, I think you would have to have this conversation where it's like, when can I get back to the gym? And I would prefer to go earlier. So what are the risks as we know them? And if we don't know them, well, are you okay? Can we come up with some sort of shared plan here based on my preferences as a human and your preferences as treating me, the patient? And I think that would yield a better response than just sort of this patriarchal relationship. We're like, well, the doc said this, and now I'm coming to ask you for a second opinion. Not that we're upset about getting asked that. It's just, it's hard to say something actionable based on that other than you have your own values. You should talk about this with your doctor. Here's what I would potentially do in your situation, you know?
Yeah, these can be challenging conversations with the amount of uncertainty and ambiguity there is out there. But I would the first thing I would think about is what are the established and relevant, like, biological tissue healing factors that we need to think about, for example, right? So if somebody just underwent an ACL reconstruction 2 days ago, and they're talking about when we can get back to the gym, that is a very, very, very different conversation than somebody who has just nonspecific, you know, just general shoulder discomfort. And they're like, when can I get back? Right? Because in one case, I'm concerned about the structural integrity of the repair that was just done. I would prefer to reduce your risk of having a re-tear of your, you know, freshly reconstructed ACL. So there are tissue healing times that inescapable. We have to respect them in this trajectory of post-operative healing and rehab. Whereas in other situations, that kind of biological tissue healing time is less of a factor. And I would argue that that's probably the case in this presentation of a septic joint. There's not a tissue healing that has to happen in there that is likely to be violated by the kid moving his shoulder around, for example. I think it's less likely, right? And so that's probably the first consideration I have. And if that's not really a factor, then the next is like, what am I actually worried about as far as risks go? Is the worst case scenario that, oh, they just hurt a little bit more? Okay, well, then we have a conversation about dosing, right? About how to auto-regulate your loading and training to keep things tolerable and keep things on a happy trajectory. But if there is, you know, concern for exacerbating some sort of a condition in a way that would prolong your situation or worsen it or lead to more medical complications, then yeah, I'm going to have to, you know, set some sort of guardrails. And there's effectively no literature randomizing people after, you know, any sort of musculoskeletal condition to like this trajectory to return to sport versus that trajectory outside of, you know, some situations like ACL where we have a bit more data. And so they're going to be made up and you just kind of have to deal with that, right? So I consult with people a lot on these things and I'm upfront with them that I'm like, hey, this I think would be reasonable. It may sound a little bit different than what your doctor said. To be clear, both of us are making this up. I'm weighing things a little bit differently than they're weighing things. Here's what I would watch out for along the way. If you notice anything like this, then maybe that would be a reason to pump the brakes a little bit, maybe get reevaluated, maybe adjust your training, but that's the best we can do. You know, that's what I got for you.
Yeah. Ultimately, I'm not concerned about people either not being able to exercise for a few weeks most of the time. In general, that's not going to represent a huge issue for folks, you know, particularly when you talk about long-term outcomes and strength, hypertrophy, physical performance and such. I'm more concerned about prolonged absences from regular physical activity. And you can make an argument that, you know, if you break somebody's routine or whatever, maybe that sends them down a road. You could also make the argument that even like a moderate length sort of restriction from exercise in vulnerable populations might be bad. So people who do not have a high level of fitness and they're, you know, now mostly immobile or sedentary for 4 to 6 weeks, that could be a huge issue. So but yeah, having the conversation, and again, probably a little more expansive than just as they're walking out the door, hey doc, when should I go exercise? I'd probably be more worried about the C. diff risk in this particular patient than recurrent septic joint, but that's just me. Yep. All right. Good job. You got that case. All right. Second case here on Case Files episode number 3. This is a good one. I'm excited for you, Dr. Austin Baraki. All right, check this out. A 20-year-old female soccer player presents to an outpatient sports medicine clinic for left medial knee pain that she's had for the last week. 1 week ago, the patient developed this left knee pain during a soccer game that caused limping. She denies any specific injury or trauma before or during the game, and she was evaluated 4 days ago by your colleague in clinic. Per the clinic note, the patient had no remarkable findings. There was no bruising, swelling, or tenderness. Range of motion and strength were both normal in the lower extremity. And she was diagnosed with a contusion and sent home with instructions to rest, use ice, and follow up in 1 week. At this follow-up, the patient reports that her left knee pain is about the same, but she's worried because it has spread to her lower leg, the anterior and medial aspect of her shin and ankle. On review of symptoms, she endorses loss of appetite, increased fatigue, and night sweats. Thoughts?
Oh boy. Yeah. So, okay. So to summarize, it sounds like a 20-year-old female soccer player, we don't have any medical history yet, but a non-traumatic left medial knee pain for a week and now associated with the spread to the lower leg. Was that pain or swelling or discoloration? What was the characterization?
She reports pain. Yeah, pain. Just pain.
Yep. Okay. And then that's associated with loss of appetite, fatigue, and night sweats. Okay. So as far as the, you know, initial differential diagnosis for this knee pain, the same kind of thought process would apply. I'm thinking about articular structures, periarticular structures like the muscles, the tendons, the ligaments, everything that's in the vasculature that passes around the knee or behind the knee. For example, the popliteal, you know, vessels, vein, artery, if there's something going on in the vascular territory behind, like a clot or a ruptured Baker cyst or all sorts of things that can happen in or about the knee. But once we add that other layer, so I think in the first case files, we talked about, for example, somebody who had chest pain and shortness of breath. And I talked about how we would like overlap those two kind of in a Venn diagram fashion. So now I have somebody not just with isolated, you know, single joint knee pain, a traumatic knee pain for a week, that would have its own kind of list of considerations. But I'm also overlaying this combination of loss of appetite, fatigue, and night sweats. And those things collectively, I tend to just lump together and describe as signs of inflammation. When patients have significant systemic inflammation going on, those are all pretty typical manifestations. That inflammation can come from things like infections, as in we saw in the last case with a septic joint or an infection in the joint space. That's one possible cause of inflammation and joint pain. Another would be cancers that can lead to systemic inflammation. Most people would recognize that, you know, significant loss of appetite, fatigue, and night sweats in combination can be signs of underlying cancers, like lymphomas, for example, can oftentimes present with symptoms like that. And then certain autoimmune conditions can manifest with loss of appetite, fatigue, night sweats, things like that. In a young female like this, autoimmune conditions and certain types of cancers can certainly happen here. One of the kind of prototypical, you know, autoimmune conditions that can cause raging inflammation in like a 20s, 30s-year-old woman would be something like Still's disease, for example, can manifest with pretty bad inflammation, rashes, joint pain, lymphadenopathy, swollen lymph nodes, things like that. So to back up again and summarize, we have, you know, non-traumatic isolated knee pain that seems to be spreading a little bit down the leg. And so I'm suspicious now for, you know, something in the joint, around the joint, something involving the lower aspect of the leg or the vessels in that area. For example, if there's a clot in a vein behind the leg leading to some extending pain, and that would fit nicely with somebody who has systemic inflammation from something like an infection, a cancer, or an autoimmune condition, because all of those things can also increase the risk of thrombosis like clotting. So what would I do next? Get some vital signs, do an exam of the area, potentially look for you know, signs of a clot in that area, and then get some basic lab work to further characterize, as well as imaging of the knee and potentially extending that down the lower leg too, to see, do we have like a tumor of the bone, which can happen more often in younger patients than in older patients, or do I need to start chasing infection, or also doing a detailed exam of the other joints and skin and other territories that can show me signs of autoimmune conditions that I might need to be thinking about as well.
All right. Well, again, as we do here, ask and ye shall receive. Physical exam, patient appears comfortable sitting on the exam table. Vital signs were normal. The physical exam was unchanged with respect to the leg. There were no deformities, trauma, redness, swelling, or tenderness to palpation noted on exam. Range of motion and strength were both normal. Distal pulses and capillary refill were also normal in the foot. Reflexes were normal and symmetrical on both sides. Abdominal exam was unremarkable. Overall, not much to see here on the old physical exam. They were able to get some labs and did some imaging. Again, this is outpatient, but yeah, we're able to get some of this. So the CBC was normal. White count was 6.9, hemoglobin 12.9, platelets 278. CRP and ESR were both normal, 0.3 and 6, respectively. Patient was negative for Lyme's disease. EBV titers revealed a previous infection, but no current active infection. Bone scan was done, also normal, and MRI of the knee was normal. While this whole workup was being conducted, however, so this is over about a week, patient developed abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting, and was subsequently sent to the ED. It was about 3 days after she was seen in clinic. On exam in the emergency department, the patient appeared uncomfortable in her bed. Her exam was significant for decreased bowel sounds and tenderness to palpation over the abdomen, most notably in the right lower quadrant. That was worse when the patient was laid flat. Repeat blood work in the emergency room was significant for a white count to 9.5, hemoglobin was 13.7, platelets were 390, CRP was 5.4, and ESR was 28. Imaging was currently unavailable, so we'll have to get your thoughts before any further imaging was done.
Okay, this is odd for sure. So, you know, I'd mentioned that the symptoms that she was previously describing were pretty characteristic for somebody with some inflammation going on, and that initial evaluation clinically, the exam of the area looked super benign, and then the labs, mainly both the CRP and the ESR being normal, is not 100% perfect for ruling out any sort of inflammatory thing, but pretty darn good. Those tests are quite useful when they're very, very low. I don't know what part of the country we're in. It sounds like, you know, an area where people at least think about Lyme as a cause of arthritis. So there's that. It'd be useful to know some of that geography or other epidemiologic or, social history related risk factors here. Outpatient bone scan to get that done quickly on a 20-year-old is also interesting. And then the MRI of the knee being normal is reassuring, although we weren't suspecting. I'll put it this way. Let's say the MRI of the knee did show something, like it showed a ligamentous tear or a tendinous injury or something like that. I would be unsatisfied by that as a sufficient explanation for everything that she has going on. So this is an important point that, you know, imaging is not, we joke about the MRI machine or the CT scanner being the answer donut. You just put somebody through it and it tells you what's going on. But that is not really the case. You have to interpret whatever results you get from these things in the context of the patient, their story, their presentation. And so if somebody had, you know, I would be very unsurprised if a 20-year-old female soccer player had some sort of finding of a meniscal injury or tear or something like that on an MRI. But then do I say, does that really explain having some loss of appetite and fatigue and night sweats and things like that? I'm dissatisfied with that as an explanation, and I would continue to broaden my search. So that initial evaluation, super reassuring, substantially lowers the probability of a whole lot of things. But then she comes in with a pretty dramatic change in her presentation, with some actual objective evidence of inflammation now, with an increase in the CRP to 5.4 from normal, which is a notable increase. The ESR is modestly increased, not terribly high, and the CBC doesn't really do a ton for me. On exam, it sounds like her symptoms are mainly located in the abdomen. And so now this opens up a new kind of differential diagnosis bucket of how we think about abdominal pain. She has some right lower quadrant abdominal pain, which is, you know, the right lower side. And we typically do approach abdominal pain. The first pass is thinking about, well, okay, what are the emergencies that we don't want to miss, right? Emergencies being like some kind of a vascular problem. This would be like a ruptured aortic aneurysm, which it does not happen in 20-year-old women for the most part. But there are other vascular things that can complicate this. Various sorts of infectious or inflammatory conditions that can manifest in the abdomen that I don't need to spend a ton of time on now. Perforations can happen in the abdomen. So somebody's intestines can perforate, and that would be an emergency. Obstructions of the gut would be another potential concern. And then in a 20-year-old woman, ectopic pregnancy would be another emergency not to miss. So at no point so far have I heard a pregnancy test. That would be something that should happen, especially because she's probably on her way to the CT scanner soon. You need that probably. You should get that first. And so then, you know, thinking anatomically about the abdomen, right lower side, of course, most people's thoughts are going to go towards the appendix is down in that area. The ovaries are down in that area. Part of the intestines are in that area. But just because somebody has pain worse than the right lower side doesn't necessarily mean that that's exactly, you know, where the focus of inflammation in this case is. It can be referred. Abdominal pain can be super weird and kind of go all over the place. It is nearly impossible for most presentations like this to make a definitive final diagnosis of an intra-abdominal process without imaging. It is exceptionally difficult. So I could throw out a list of itises affecting nearly every structure in the abdomen, and they can be plausible causes for what's going on here. Prioritizing one versus the other is pretty difficult at this stage. And then the last thing I'm trying to do is like, can I overlay this somehow with what was going on in the knee and the shin and the leg and stuff like that? And that overlap is still pretty nebulous to me. So, you know, when somebody has an inflammatory situation, I think about infections. I think about autoimmune diseases, like I mentioned some earlier. I think about malignancies. In this case, it'd be thinking about something like a lymphoma or something like that would be, you know, a little bit higher on my list. And then she definitely needs a contrasted CT of her abdomen and pelvis, as well as a pregnancy test beforehand, before I can make a ton more progress.
You know, just to
and a urinalysis. Sorry, I would add
that. And to go off that, yeah. So no, now granted, sometimes when case reports are written up, they don't like do every report every single test that was done. But I'm like, where was the pregnancy test? Like, yeah. You know, first thing. Anyway, okay. Well, anyway, they instead of doing an abdominal CT, they did a bedside abdominal ultrasound, which revealed a massively enlarged appendix, particularly at its tip, and shows she was diagnosed with appendicitis, had an emergent appendectomy. She was discharged home post-op day 2 with complete resolution of symptoms and leg pain, full return to soccer within 6 weeks. Now, the pearls that I wanted to cover here was, again, the differential, this expansive differential over like lower extremity pain, but in this particular case, migratory lower extremity pain. Because to your point earlier, if somebody came in with knee pain, right, and then it was sort of migrating down their leg to the ankle, you're not thinking, man, that ACL is really doing some work. That meniscus is really doing some work. They may have that too, or it might be historical, may not be related at all. But so this migratory change forces you to not only broaden your differential to outside the musculoskeletal system, but also outside the leg even, into the abdomen. So I was trying to put this together in my brain, like, well, huh? Because the presentation, like, it does not make a ton of sense. Like, you don't have the classic laboratory signs and symptoms or whatever, only the physical exam with the tenderness to palpation over the right lower quadrant, especially that got worse when it was laid flat. There's like a bunch of different signs, so to speak. That's the psoas sign, as it were. So I'm thinking like maybe inflammatory mediators involving the appendicitis migrated to the leg or like irritation of the abdominal wall and like the affected lumbosacral nerves. So that's technically like an L4 dermatomal distribution. I don't know, man. I'm just trying to like put this together to make it make sense in my brain. But yeah, I think the big pearl here is like, just because someone has knee pain, so to speak, doesn't mean that like the thing's in the knee necessarily. I don't know. Can you imagine somebody getting this wrong if they kind of overlooked the constitutional symptoms and were just like, oh, I got knee pain and a little bit of a bellyache? You're probably fine. Just, you know, decrease the RP.
I mean, blowing off the knee pain in this case would not have led to a bad outcome because there wasn't actually going on in the knee. Tying this to the appendicitis is definitely odd. I am not aware of a referral pattern from the appendix to the lower leg. There are certainly situations where that in like the upper thigh, kind of groin, you know, upper leg area, I find to be pretty plausible. It'd be interesting to see if this is a known phenomenon. So this all ultimately makes sense. And it sounds like a pretty characteristic presentation of this. So glad they were able to catch it on bedside ultrasound. That's not something that is always going to be the case. Ultrasound has imperfect sensitivity for this kind of thing, but spared her a bit of radiation. So that's great. And yeah, glad she got better.
Yeah, they were saying that the appendix was retrocecal in location, which apparently has some abnormal sort of nerve potential transmission and such. But still, interesting case. I did not think that after having gone through that and been like, why is this case so weird? I was like, he won't rule out infection or appendicitis, especially with that abdominal exam. But like, it'd be hard to arrive there unless I think you were the one running all the tests and having it real time. Yeah. So we'll give you half point. I'll give you half point on that.
You're stingy with the points, man.
as is my nature. All right. Last case here we're going to get to. This is about a 22-year-old male who was unable to complete his military fitness test. And we'll come back to that right after this break. For all the golfers in the audience, you've probably heard of PXG by seeing them on the PGA Tour in the hands of guys like Joel Damon, Zach Johnson, and Luke List. Well, they're bringing that same passion for excellence to their new line of apparel. And I got to say, they nailed it. I just got another polo from them, and both the fit and performance are excellent. They're really versatile as well, meaning I can wear them out to eat or take a meeting without signaling to everyone that I'm about to play golf. PXG Apparel has something for everyone. They got pants, polos, sweaters, hats, quarter zips, joggers, jackets, skirts, everything you could want. I've got a few of their hats and a few of their polos, but some of their mid-layers look great too. We've got a special offer for our audience. If you're looking to elevate your style game on and off the course, check out the PXG Spring and Summer 2024 collections. Head over to pxg.com/barbell and use the code barbell at checkout to save 10% on all apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. That's code B-A-R-B-E-L-L to save 10% on apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of my questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Vim, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
All right, we're back here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, case files number 3 with Dr. Austin Baraki, last case. All right, are you ready for this?
Let's do it.
It's your time to shine. Okay. 22-year-old, previously healthy African-American male college student presents to the emergency room after being unable to complete his military fitness assessment due to severe leg pain. The patient reports that he was unable to run the final 20 yards or so of his 1.5-mile run due to severe thigh pain that made it difficult to even stand or walk. He denies loss of consciousness, but was unable to walk without assistance. He had a similar episode 3 weeks ago where the patient presented again to the emergency department for the same reason. In both instances, he says he was able to do the push-up and sit-up test immediately before without any sort of difficulty. And he'd run this 1.5-mile run test multiple times, though he says he often has, quote, muscle cramps during the run. At the previous visit, the patient had extreme tenderness to palpation in the thighs bilaterally, especially at end-range knee flexion and extension. At the time, his CK levels were over 5,000. His lactate dehydrogenase was 1,332, but there were no red blood cells in his urine. He was diagnosed with exertional rhabdomyolysis, which improved with IV saline administration. He got IV fluids, and he was discharged home and instructed to drink lots of water and avoid exertion until medically cleared. 2 days later, the patient reported a complete resolution of symptoms. He has no significant past medical history, denies use of medication, supplements, or drugs, and has no recent illnesses. The review of systems is positive for increased thirst, urination, and weight loss. Thoughts?
Okay. So you said a 22-year-old African-American male who's having, I would say, episodes of recurrent severe leg pain associated with exertion. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it the same leg both times? Or was it, both legs?
Both legs, unable to continue walking, running, and he actually had difficulty standing.
I see. Okay. And then on his evaluation, you gave me some labs that sounded a bit like a mild case of rhabdo. Did you give me, I was trying to track everything as you said it, did you give me the leg exam, like a vascular pulse exam, things like that?
Yeah, completely normal. Basically just had the significant findings on the leg exam was that he had tendinitis to palpation over both the quadriceps and the hamstrings. But
okay.
Yeah, pulses were normal, reflexes were normal, otherwise unremarkable outside of pain in the upper portion of the thigh.
And then the last thing was some increased thirst, increased urination, and some weight loss, it sounds like.
Correct.
Okay. So for this, I'll take this in parts, I guess, for this episodic exertional bilateral thigh pain that is extremely limiting, the first thing that I would think about would be some form of a vascular problem. In a older patient, maybe with a smoking history or something like that, we think about things like claudication, which is kind of like the analog of angina when people get chest pain with exertion, except it's angina in your legs. When you have insufficient blood flow, oxygenation getting to the tissues, and that can lead to ischemic, you know, pain of that musculature. Having claudication like that from atherosclerosis would be pretty unusual in a 22-year-old who is able to complete other tasks like doing a bunch of push-ups and stuff like that, unless there's some kind of focal vascular anomaly in that area. So, you know, some sort of lower aortic or iliac or something like that, some kind of a problem with his vasculature that when there is dramatically increased demand on the musculature in terms of oxygen needs of his thigh muscles while doing a run, that and they're not able to get supplied with sufficient oxygen, then they start to hurt and break down a little bit, as shown by, again, this like relatively mild case of rhabdo that he's had. If it's not a vascular anomaly, there are one other thing that I thought about along in this case. You mentioned he's 22, an African-American male, is patients with sickle cell disease, they can have vaso-occlusive, you know, episodes, meaning that their blood cells sickle and block off their blood vessels, and that can lead to similar types of ischemic severe pain in certain areas of their body. If he's having exercise-associated vaso-occlusive, you know, episodes, that could potentially explain severe pain with exertion and even some of the, you know, mild rhabdo that he's experiencing. So I think that the first couple things that I'd want to do, aside from just, you know, usual vital signs it'd be easier if I did my own exam on this instead of hearing it secondhand, of course, but a vascular assessment, that could be a venous, you know, as well as potentially even an arterial, but it sounds like he has really good pulses. So that would be the first thing. And then doing some basic labs and looking for signs, potentially even screening for sickle cell disease as something that can manifest in this way. Typically, it's something that gets screened out in the military context, at least in the U.S., but not always 100% perfect at screening that kind of thing out. And I don't even know if this is a U.S.-based case anyway. The last thing that you mentioned, some increased thirst, some increased urination, and some weight loss. There's many things that can cause that combination. The most kind of classic or textbook combination or a condition that can lead to that triad would be diabetes. And this could be type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes. There are various other subtypes of diabetes that can lead to, firstly, increased urination, because people's having elevated blood sugar leads to increased urination. The increased urination then leads to increased thirst. And if you are if you have diabetes and you're unable to get glucose into your cells, then you're basically in this permanent kind of catabolic state, unable to use the energy that is floating around in your bloodstream, and you can lose weight as well, especially as you pee out all that glucose. I won't go too much further down the weeds of what can cause those conditions, because it's also possible not that he has increased urination and then as a result has increased thirst, but sometimes patients have increased thirst, they drink a ton, and then that leads to increased urination. The causation can go either way. But the first thing I would do is just a finger stick blood glucose, potentially check an A1C, or there are other tests that you can use if you suspect something like sickle cell disease to assess for diabetes. And then only if that's negative would I go further down that rabbit hole. So that's kind of my initial assessment here. Of course, I would hammer him as a 22-year-old who's doing any kind of physical activity, as we saw in one of our previous cases about supplement use and things like that. Even though the initial history said no, sometimes I've had to ask people, "What are you using?" Repeatedly on several subsequent days in the hospitalization before either they finally tell me or they finally remember, "Oh yeah, I recently started using this new supplement," and that can certainly, you know, lead to, you know, increased risk for rhabdomyolysis or thirst and urination related issues and things like that.
Mm. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have I have a physical exam for you, but it is not going to be sufficient for what you want. Okay. I have labs for you also, but again,
I like labs.
They're not going to be sufficient for you. I still think that you can get, I think you can get home on this one. I believe you. So on exam, the patient again had marked tenderness to palpation over both thighs, along with pain on passive stretch. So this was located again over his quadriceps and his hamstrings. Nothing below the knee as far as symptoms go. Again, pulses were normal and there was no evidence that the patient, you know, he didn't have any like dry, cool, or mottled extremities, anything like that. His vital signs were normal. His neurological exam was also normal. His labs were significant for a glucose to 389 milligrams per deciliter. His bicarb was 16. His potassium was 3.3 and his CK was 918. So again, I told you these were going to be insufficient for what you want to know, but I think you have a pretty decent picture of something that's going on at least.
Yeah, this patient automatically meets criteria for having diabetes. Having a glucose of 389, not great. So that's something that immediately catches my attention. So I'd be giving that a bit more thought as far as, is this a new diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, or is this some other, you know, more esoteric kind of cause or type of diabetes, of which there are many that I can probably spare the audience right now relating to pancreatic issues or other endocrine-related issues. The bicarbonate of 16 is low and raises concern that he may actually, similar to one of our previous cases, be in diabetic ketoacidosis or DKA. So I would also be doing some additional testing to evaluate for that. The potassium is reassuring if he has active rhabdo, and you'd want to fix that a little bit if you're going to start treating diabetic ketoacidosis, and the CK here is actually better than it was before. So when I combine, you know, this new diagnosis of diabetes, severe tenderness over his thighs, maybe some exertional rhabdomyolysis, I'm a bit less worried about a primary vascular problem. I'm still worried about the, you know, potential sickle cell contribution that I think this is more recency bias because I've seen some cases like this before, including in the military population. Diabetes can lead to certain complications affecting the muscles. There's something called diabetic myonecrosis that can happen. Patients can get muscle infarcts. They can get pyomyositis. They can get infections of the muscles, and that does also classically affect the thighs. We're not really seeing a ton of other signs of infection, at least based on the skimpy amount of data that you've provided here. And so, you know, there could be a lot of, there's still several possibilities of what could be going on here. And so I think the next steps, aside from giving this patient a bunch of fluids, giving him some potassium, giving him some insulin, getting control of his diabetes and doing some subsequent testing to get to the bottom of that, he may actually benefit from some dedicated imaging of his thigh musculature. So sometimes in these situations, I've done MRI of the muscles and it can show me, is there evidence of a myositis, meaning an active inflammation of the muscle from, for example, an autoimmune condition like polymyositis or dermatomyositis, which I don't think is going on here because this is a pretty acute presentation. But, you know, nothing's ever completely off the table at this stage in the game. There are kinds of infectious myositis that would light up on an MRI or a muscle infarct or something like that. And those can all be either targets for making a diagnosis or potentially getting some kind of a muscle biopsy to look at it under the microscope and see if you have an identifiable kind of histopathology. So again, inflammatory myositis or myopathy, or infectious or muscle infarct or vascular problem or hematologic problem like sickle cell disease causing vaso-occlusive disease and ischemic, you know, muscle pain and injury are still all, you know, fair game at this point.
Would it surprise you that there was no imaging reported of the lower extremities?
I mean, if they ended up treating his diabetes and got better control of all that and his symptoms completely resolved, if I was managing that in the hospital and I fixed his you know, probable mild case of diabetic ketoacidosis and everything disappeared and I was able to send him home, then I wouldn't necessarily chase that a ton further. If I got all that fixed and he was still like, I cannot use my legs because it hurts so bad for me to move around, then fair enough, I'm going to chase that further. So it's, you know, if it would be unusual, I think, for just DKA to manifest with just severe debilitating thigh pain in an isolated fashion. Is it plausible? I would only be comfortable even approaching that as a final diagnosis if treating the former completely resolved the latter.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, not a great outcome here. So this individual was admitted with a working diagnosis of dehydration plus a new onset diabetes with a mild case of ketoacidosis, as you mentioned. He was admitted, started on IV fluids, transferred to the ICU. However, upon transfer to the ICU, his legs became tense, mottled, weak, and had decreased sensation to touch. The patient became obtunded. At this time, the patient had significant acidemia. His pH was in the gutter. Hyperkalemia, hyperphosphatemia, hypocalcemia. Urinalysis was positive for myoglobin. It was brown in color. Aggressive DKA management was subsequently started in addition to increasing fluids. Interestingly, shortly thereafter, the patient started oozing out of his IV site and he developed thrombocytopenia based on labs. You can stop me at any time, by the way.
Sure. Do you think this is a point to stop?
could be. Something prior.
Yeah, I mean, this is a dramatic escalation in what's happened. We're juggling a critically ill patient with multiple issues going on at this point. You know, the evolution is quite concerning. The DKA at this point is like the least of our concerns in that was relatively mild and pretty straightforward to get under control. The rest of the changes that you described sound quite a lot like accelerating rhabdomyolysis in terms of the electrolyte changes and things like that he manifested. The worsening pain modeling of the extremities again ties me back into a vascular concern, and him developing having or developing compartment syndrome in the legs, which is something we've talked about previously in the context of rhabdomyolysis, is plausible here as a cause. So I'm concerned about, you know, on one hand, we have mild DKA, we have, you know, a relatively mild case of rhabdo that's significantly worsened, potentially related to ongoing compartment syndrome in both of his thighs is certainly a concern. Getting pressure measurements there would be useful in case of emergent interventions needed to salvage his limbs. And then the oozing from the IV sites is kind of a classic description of a patient going into disseminated intravascular coagulation or DIC. And DIC is really just a syndrome. It's something that can be triggered or set off by lots of different things, including just critical illness itself can set it off. So sometimes patients can have severe infections, sepsis can set off DIC, trauma can set off DIC, hematologic conditions can set off DIC, pregnancy can set off DIC. There's many of them. And so this patient would be getting a lot of intensive care at this time to stabilize his DKA, to further assess the extremities, because you would prefer that he not A, die, and B, lose his limbs potentially. So assessing the, you know, vascular situation in his limbs, you said, I think you might have mentioned his pulse exam was getting a bit tenuous. And so getting some surgeons involved as an absolute emergency, like within the next 20 minutes, they need to be here and doing some evaluation, because I'm mostly concerned about either thrombosis or compartment syndrome going on in this patient's limbs, and then reversing the DIC while we're also doing a pretty extensive evaluation to identify, is there any other potential triggering factor, underlying cause that could be contributing here?
Yeah. So surgery was consulted. They actually did a pressure measurement of his thighs, and the pressures were over 30 into the mid-30s, both bilaterally. He had multiple fasciotomies. But he was becoming further obtunded and ultimately was intubated and placed on a ventilator. His He was diagnosed with DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulation. He was treated with multiple rounds of blood and plasma products. But his acidosis and hyperkalemia remained problematic. He subsequently started on hemodialysis and was not really responsive to that. Post-fasciotomy, he was still on a ventilator. Subsequent serial examinations revealed additional compartment syndrome of the glutes. So he was taken back to the operating room for fasciotomies over his gluteal compartment with further debridement of necrotic lower extremity muscles. Despite the management of the acidosis, the hyperkalemia, and the compartment syndrome, his DIC worsened and ultimately led to renal failure. Again, multiple debridements of necrotic tissue was going on. He had this is hospital day 23 at this point. His CK peaked at 9 million. And he was subsequently started on hyperbaric oxygen therapy to try to salvage the non-necrotic muscle that remained. But again, he's still intubated at this time. So hospital day 24 comes around, and despite apparent clinical stabilization and improvement, he had no brainstem reflexes at this time. CT and MRI scans of the brain revealed infarctions throughout the upper cervical cord, the brainstem, midbrain, and the cerebral cortex. After 3 days of absent higher neurological function and following discussion with family, life support was withdrawn and the patient was pronounced dead. Autopsy confirmed multiple infarcts throughout the spleen, brain, and kidneys consistent with sickling. Postmortem tests were positive for sickle cell trait. So, which is interesting because you brought this up about 15 minutes ago.
I think I said that right at the beginning. Wow.
Yeah.
That is an incredible case and super, super unfortunate outcome that his disease progressed to that point and was not reversible. Deeply unfortunate. Yeah.
Yeah. The interesting thing, I mean, his history with the multiple, like if I said that the patient collapsed 20 yards before the end of the race, and then at a subsequent time, 70 yards before the end of the fitness assessment and had multiple issues with muscle cramps, I think collapse would have like clued somebody or anybody in who has even heard of.
I don't know that that's the case. I've seen one case of ECAST before, which is exercise collapse associated with sickle cell trait. And that was a very memorable case that I had patients, one that I've actually referenced before, anonymized, of course, on the podcast, some of the worst cases of rhabdomyolysis that I've ever seen in that situation. That one, fortunately, had a good outcome, although a very complex hospital course along the way, similarly temporarily requiring dialysis, having some abscesses and other things. Definitely a known thing. And I think I think the only reason that I got this as early as I did was because I've seen a patient with this before, and that clued me into it. But I think a lot of folks are not aware of ECAST or that sickle cell trait really can lead to any significant, you know, complications. They think of like sickle cell disease is definitely the real deal, but trait can also have some complications, although it doesn't have all the classic hematologic complications that we see with people with full-blown homozygous disease.
Yeah, this is a pretty controversial thing. You'd mentioned screening in the military, but there was even used to be screening at college sports level. So like in 2010, the NCAA enacted a new policy on sickle cell trait that required all students to provide documentation of their sickle cell trait status or a written release prior to beginning activity. So this was 2010. But in 2012, the American Society of Hematology made policy reversal recommendations based on ethical grounds and the lack of scientific evidence to support the NCAA's policy. And the military is caught somewhere in between because there's not a uniform sort of screening practice across all branches and all billets and such. So yeah, pretty interesting here. I mean, I think the pearl here is just knowing that ECAST is a thing and that further sickle cell trait not only increases the risk of rhabdomyolysis, but can get much, much worse when it's compounded by, you know, this individual had newly onset diabetes, DKA, potentially the environment in which they were running in was not suitable. I think worse in colder environments, for example, for these folks.
Yeah.
Just a lot of other stuff going on that, again, yeah, you'd have to have a lot of medical training to even arrive at this. But these case files, I think, are mostly interesting for knowing, like, well, what happens beyond your current knowledge level? It's interesting to be clear, but also, like, yeah, you have an expanded differential if you were, you know, encounter this at some point.
Yeah, I agree that I get a lot of value out of these kind of exercises. And then I think being forced to be put on the spot and, as I said at the beginning, come up with all this stuff off the dome is a unique challenge in itself. But I think it just makes you more facile when you're trying to do this in real life. So I know we have a pretty substantial listener of, you know, people in the medical community or medical students. I've had students or interns or residents that I work with tell me that they listen. And so maybe they get some value out of this too. So, and then for the rest, yeah, I know that people like medical TV, and so maybe this delivers a fraction of that level of entertainment to them too.
Yeah, we need more attractive like stars though. Like, how can we recruit very dreamy hosts here or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if we come up with case reports for like exercise related stuff. Like, you know, like something interesting for like a programming perspective. I don't know that anybody's detailing those case reports in a suitable way, but yeah, maybe we can bridge that gap. But yeah, man, super interesting cases. I'm going to give you 2.5 out of 3. I'm not keeping track. I'm not keeping track, but I think that's an excellent batting average.
At least I continue to exceed your low expectations of me.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. So, you know, yeah, you're killing it. In any case, hey guys, thanks you so much for listening to the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Again, this is Case Files number 3. If you like this format, we have 2 other episodes. So if you haven't listened to those, go back through the archive, check those out within the last few months or so. But before you go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.